When I was a young man, I was very fond of travelling to remote parts of the world. I did this under the pretext of researching the mythologies of each country, but my first object was to reach an understanding of mankind. I've long since realised that one can only rediscover by such researches the complexity of the human soul, and that there are many doors in this fantastic structure better left unopened if one is to live in peace with one's fellows. In my old age, then, I have devoted my attention exclusively to research into the manuscripts of ancient myths and legends, preferring to ignore their wider implications and instead treat them as puzzles to be solved by unchangeable, absolute laws. It is the last refuge of an uncertain, disillusioned old scholar, and I hope the reader will not judge me too harshly for it, for, as I have said, I was once an ardent seeker after something called the truth. It was not until I sensed that I was close to this elusive phenomenon that it occurred to me that truth is really not a desirable commodity at all, but rather has something unbearably repulsive about it. I hasten to add that this conviction has none of the authority that my academic skills rely so much upon. It is the intuitive experience of an animal which draws back with a shiver from some apparently innocuous object. My first and most intense encounter with this sensation came about while I was still a student at the university in which I now lecture. I was collecting evidence for a theory that the mythologies of our northern countries can be divided into three general thematic groups. At that age, I still believed that such categorizations revealed more about the subject matter than the critic. I still work with this assumption, but my faith in it has long since left me. My researches brought me to the backward country of Rigara, which borders our land to the north, but is surprisingly little known for a place so near. In many ways, Rigara is the most remote country I have visited, and certainly the least pleasant. There is only one university in the place, and when I visited it, I could find no archives of any relevance to my research. The professor of literature, a man more like a gardener than an academic, indeed, I fancy I glimpsed rows of seed catalogues on his shelves, and, unless I'm much misled, a trowel in his jacket pocket, could only advise me to visit a distant village to the north, where the country's few myths still had some currency. Knowing that my command of the harsh Rigaran language was hopelessly inadequate for this task, I nonetheless set out for this far-off village, the last station on the railway line, telling myself that I could hardly discover less than I had already done. Even on the train, sitting uncomfortably in the hollow of the seat imprinted by countless generations of Rigaran, and watching the desolate moorland through which we were endlessly passing, I was filled with a dull premonition and the thought that, after all, perhaps the whole world, stripped of its distracting detail, its precarious artifice, was one vast Rigara. That this proposition could easily be refuted by simple logic was little comfort, for the impression still remained, and by the time I was standing alone in the village square with the slow grating of the departing train behind me and the last front door slammed shut by the last of my uncommunicative fellow passengers in front, my unease had become acute. It was a relief to reach the hotel, the far end of the village, perched on the very edge of the moor. I was shown to a low room dominated by heavy black roof beams that then led, with a minimum of words, but in such a way as to show that I had little choice in the matter, to the bar. Here I was left alone. The room was remarkably dark, although there was a fire in the grate and a few lamps were fixed to the walls. In the light cast by these lamps, I could see one, then two, frames. On closer inspection, I discovered them to contain Gothic prints depicting scenes that were unmistakably mythological, yet completely unfamiliar to me. In one, a large gull with human eyes loomed over a hovel in which could be seen a mother with both arms around her children. In the next, two identical figures were locked together so that their limbs seemed to flow unbroken from one to the other. The only visible face, though crudely drawn, was set in a ghastly expression of hate, teeth bared, eyes wide. Just as I was turning hastily to the next frame, I almost stumbled over a man. He was sitting looking up at me with the narrow eyes which are a Rigaran characteristic. There is only one greeting in Rigaran, and it is a formal one. This we now exchanged, for at such close proximity we had no alternative but to acknowledge each other. I quickly explained that I was a foreigner, and that my command of the language was not great. I had expected the man to be unfriendly, or at least reserved, when he heard this, but he seemed instead considerably relieved. I told him of my interest in the prince, but he was not helpful on the subject. "Leave that superstitious rubbish to the Sixers," he said, fixing my eyes with his unblinking stare. I was not sure whether I had misheard the word, or whether it actually was a corruption of the Rigaran for six. The man seemed to have been waiting for just such a question, for now he leaned forward, never dropping his intense gaze, and began to address me excitedly in low tones. "You're a foreigner, so it's only fair you should be warned. You see, Rigara is in a state of civil war." I remembered the broad, quiet streets of the capital and the pale Rigaran faces I had seen, and decided that this nation lacked the vitality for such a spirited enterprise as war. "You exaggerate, of course," I replied with a smile. But the man's face became even more serious, and although he was now standing level with me, his eyes were no more than a glow under his heavy brows. "Please," he said, "come with me. I have a house nearby in the moor where you can meet my family, but I cannot speak of this matter here." His hand was on my arm. I was about to protest that we were quite alone here, but then I noticed that somebody had now appeared behind the bar, and there was even a thin figure sitting in the opposite corner on a stool. Both were watching us with suspicion, so I let myself be led to the door by my companion. I was, after all, much intrigued by his manner, and my faith in the virtue of all human nature was still untarnished. Outside, the clouds were gathering ominously above, I asked the man what he had meant by Sixers. "You mustn't be deceived by appearances," he began, "for although we may seem a peaceful and contented people, a model of honest, sturdy principles, these are in fact the very circumstances which men like myself are trying to achieve for our children. And in every step, these admirable intentions, those who subscribe to them are known as Niners, are undermined by the despicable Sixers." My friend's agitation gave me no reason to believe him to be joking, but more than once I glanced furtively back at the receding village and wondered if it might not be wise to make some excuse and return to the hotel. But I knew that if I did this, the words Sixer and Niner would echo over and over in my mind all night, and that I could not leave the man without hearing further explanation. "But these Sixers," I asked, "who are they? How do they operate?" "Aha!" shouted the man. His enthusiasm was quite unsettling. "There you pinpoint the vilest stratagem of the Sixer. Even if a Niner could overcome his revulsion and attempt to discover the characteristics of Sixers, he would be doomed to failure. They're so cunning that they are unable to be distinguished by a Niner. I myself have never seen a Rigaran of whom I could say without doubt, that is a Sixer. Although if I could, I assure you, the fellow would not live long enough to confirm or deny it." I was tempted to ask my friend how he knew these people existed, but decided that to doubt the very basis of such a passionate belief would hardly endear me to this crusader, who after all knew the country and its people so much better than I did. His next words, however, went some way towards answering my unspoken question. "You, my friend, are interested in our traditions. Well, I cannot of course speak for my fellow Rigarans, for we are a solitary people, but in my opinion what I am telling you now is older and stronger than any myth. Every Rigaran is either a Niner or a Sixer, though it is not certain that they know it, and if they do, that they use those words to describe it. What is certain is that the matter is never so much as hinted at amongst ourselves. That you, even as an outsider, should be hearing this is most exceptional, even although it is, I am convinced, the single most important characteristic of our nation, a curse upon us all, and it is the constant duty of Niners like myself to devote every effort to the destruction of the Sixers." I had to walk at a slight distance from my friend, since he had the inconvenient habit of emphasizing his words with violent and abandoned gestures of the arms. Several times he had hit me, apparently without noticing, and a stinging sensation in my cheek suggested that his sharp nails had cut me. What concerned me more than this, however, was our position on the moor. The light was fading, the heavy clouds threatened at any moment to open and pour torrents upon us, and neither the village nor any form of habitation was visible on the sparse undulations of the moor. My friend, however, strode on with the same air of certainty as before, and when I asked him if his house was much further, he merely said, "No, no, not at all," and continued, "But tradition, yes, that is strong, strong but subtle. It is the private and unannounced duty of a Niner father to ensure that his children grow up in the knowledge that they are Niners. He will tell them so directly, in a serious moment, as soon as they're old enough to understand, and repeatedly after that, though each time the allusion will become more discreet, until it becomes after a while a certain look in the eyes, a stern but proud look in which his children will understand the importance and immensity of the responsibility laid before them. This, my friend, this is the honourable tradition of the Niner Rigaran. It is not something you will find in books or pictures. Indeed, I can only infer its existence from my own personal experience as son of my father and father of my sons, and far be it from me to make general my own private experience. No, that kind of trick I leave to the Sixers." Suddenly the man, I was thinking of him less and less as a friend, stopped and faced me. His features were almost unrecognisably distorted, and immediately I recalled the print of the wrestlers in the hotel. "Really, I must go back to my room," I said, "much as I regret missing your family." But the man had clearly not heard. He leaned forward, and flecks of his spittle mingled the rain that now cascaded all around. His words seemed to be snatched by the howling wind and forced right through me. "It is rumoured," he yelled, "it is rumoured that Sixers think of themselves..." Here a laugh interrupted him, although it could have been the rumble of approaching thunder. "Think of themselves as Niners. Such perversion proves them to be Sixers." The flash of lightning showed how far the man now was from me, but his words still rang as clear as before. "That, my friend, is the definition of a Sixer. But please, won't you meet my two lads, good Niners, both?" I waited no longer, but turned and ran blindly back down the road. Several times that night I thought I glimpsed the lights of the man's house before me, and desperately changed my direction. I now attribute this to the lightning and my fever. At last, however, I reached the village and threw myself, terrified and exhausted, to the floor of the first room I entered, which was the bar. I left the village on the next train and spoke to no one until I reached my own country. The subject of my book had to be changed slightly, but I erased all mention of Rigara and concentrated my studies on the rural areas surrounding our capital. As it turned out, however, even this modest aim was beyond me, for in a matter of months we were at war with Rigara, and I was called upon to fight. The main object of our country was the Rigaran mineral resources, and the authorities were united in maintaining that the struggle would be short-lived and ultimately of benefit to both countries. The wealth generated by the newly acquired minerals would be invested in developing Rigara, and so on. But despite their almost complete lack of weaponry, the Rigarans proved extraordinarily hard to defeat. Amongst the regular soldiers of our army, stories circulated about the Rigarans which treated them as heroes rather than enemies, and both sides suffered appalling casualties. My own experiences in the war are something I choose to forget, but suffice it to say that the Rigaran civil war, being almost exclusively the subject of my thoughts and nightmares at the time, played no small part in the execution of my duty. When at last our forces marched into the enemy capital, they discovered a people remarkably united in spirit. Whether this denies or confirms the exposition of the national character I received as a young student, I have never been able to decide, and indeed I have no wish to, for since those days I have devoted my attention to the legends of ancient times, and the only conflict I have allowed myself is to dispute with certain colleagues in the subject, the bearing of a mythology upon the daily lives of the people. The freedom of travel. These train journeys were all right, but he was always on the lookout for a little house. When the guide was standing in the aisle, recreating with amplified words a passing landmark, he was pressing his nose to the opposite window, formulating an offer for the modest property with its sturdy woman and laden clothesline. "On condition that pegs and basket remain, let's say the contents of these tightly packed bags, you can count it yourself. It is a sum to cover any alternative arrangements you may wish to make. Quite ample, quite ample. But if you'd consider remaining here, you could spare yourself much of the turmoil. I know it only too well, being urged faster and faster along unfamiliar streets by the weight of all one's possessions and belongings, which tumble recklessly behind until one's too dizzy and breathless to know which is possessor, which possessed, and who belongs to whom." But she had declined the offer, for the house had skidded to the west to reveal a husband squatting with a watering can in shrubs, clearly anticipating a fertile future as he directed the aluminium nozzle to foliage and roots. What were the bags packed with? Nothing which could be bartered for things out there in the real world, that was certain. No, shirts and things, applicable only to himself, not even worthy of hanging damp on that crowded clothesline, now far behind and superseded by rock-strewn fields dotted with unmanned agricultural machinery. When had he last opened the bags? The luggage rack was high, a manoeuvre such as standing on the seat in this rushing, decorous train was not to be undertaken lightly. Passport, toothbrush, pen for the postcards, all essentials were in his pockets. Heaven knew how many border checks there had been, always in the middle of the night, when he had missed the opportunity to examine the contents of his own bags while the customs officers were sifting through them. This attributable to the acute considerateness of the men who would lean over you while you slept, reaching out with their long arms for your bags, conducting their search in silence, and even slipping their stamp like a dried leaf into your passport, the only sign of their visit, discovered by accident the next day as you listlessly flicked through the visas page. So, it had been some time since he had weighed up his possessions. There may even have been some long-forgotten souvenirs nestling amongst the pressed clothes. A schoolboy diary might have slipped between a shirt and its supporting card. Perhaps a half-exposed film retained latent images in the darkness of his Kodak. It was certainly a cause for speculation, but he was inhibited from satisfying his curiosity by the inevitable attentions of the stewards. Not for a minute would they allow a passenger to strain himself in his efforts to reach the luggage rack. Two of them would assist. What else were they here for? And then the inevitable questions, polite and helpful. Was Sir in need of something in particular? If so, they could procure it in no time from the kitchen or the publications trolley, or if it was something rather more recherché, the next station. But Sir mustn't put himself out. He should let one of them, Marcel, would do it, wait while he removed the desired item and then replaced the bag on the rack so it would no longer inconvenience him. Not even the most cumbersome bag could have been such an inconvenience as those stewards. So he had to endure his nagging curiosity about the bags. But more than this was involved. Were he suddenly to throw himself off the train at a station, it would have to be without the bags, which the stewards watched more closely than the passengers. This would be possible only if the degree and extent of loss involved could be calculated and counted against the likely gains of escape. But to examine the contents of the bags with such a calculation in mind would be to arouse the suspicion and close observation of the stewards, and there would be the end of one's hopes. There was, of course, the possibility of being awake when the customs officers came round. He ignored the rumour that these long-limbed men were not only unobtrusive, but positively soporific. But this would mean remaining awake every night, since the approach of a boarder was never predictable. Aside from the danger that, eyes closed in a semblance of sleep, you could actually miss the silent officials even awake, there was the risk of arousing suspicion by sleeping during the daytime. And who knew, it might just happen that a boarder should be crossed at midday, and he would miss his only opportunity after all. Nothing aboard the train was certain. The reluctant conclusion which constantly faced him was that he could neither launch himself into that world beyond the tinted glass with his possessions, nor without them. He could neither barter nor beg at modest, sturdy houses or timeless milling monuments. His only sure freedom was to select the object of his attention as they flew by, to ignore the crackle of the speaker. He could hear it now, an electronic clearing of the throat that signalled the impending direction, the condescending command, selected permissible sensual emphasis, crackle. No! He would look through his own window, choose a detail of intensely and exclusively personal significance. His imagination would leap to it through glass and possess it and create it. Ladies and gentlemen, came the commanding voice of the guide, and he laughed out loud to hear it. The well-rehearsed, compelling tones beat through the carriage uselessly, like a great dying bluebottle. Already he was scanning the hills for his landscape. His eye swept the waters of the lake, flitted on coloured sails. Ladies and gentlemen, your attention is drawn to... He could hardly see through his laughter the motion of the train, of his eyeballs, the infinite variety of the landscape. The extent of his freedom was immeasurable. Built during the 1920s, the longest tunnel in the world, you are asked to remain quite still in the darkness. The letter. He had been driving round in circles. He couldn't stop because there were no places, and besides, he had a destination to reach, if only the road wouldn't keep doubling back in itself. Not that it was always quite the same. For instance, he noticed that the buildings were getting taller and were beginning to lean together overhead. Soon they met as a ceiling. So perhaps he was approaching his destination. Somebody was reading the invitation, sitting next to him. They would be late, that was certain. Oh, but it was all right. He had arrived. It was his hostess in the passenger seat. He was driving around a crowded hall. Somebody handed him a glass of wine through the window. The car began to spin smoothly across the floor. People were staring disapprovingly because now the pianist was waiting for silence to begin his performance. The first notes shrilled disturbingly. He silenced the alarm clock and opened the curtains. Objects took a moment to materialise in the brightness. It was a sunny morning. He almost missed the letter. He was standing by the pigeonholes, shuffling the envelopes in his hand, and he put it to the back of the pile before recognising his own name. It had no stamp, just his name, his room number, his house. He put it in his pocket and entered the dining hall. He set the tray down on the table. Two girls nearby looked up. He glanced at them when he was sitting down. He had expected no letter. It lay on the table between him and the two girls. The envelope was handwritten. The girl diagonally opposite him had short dark hair and was holding a coffee cup. She reminded him of someone. She was talking about all the distractions she'd had in the room the evening before. Just when she thought there was peace at last, in had come Steve from upstairs. It looked like a girl's handwriting, and the envelope was personal size, not an office envelope, not brown, but white. It was a letter from a girl in halls. Yes, he knew the one it would be. She sat in front of him in moral philosophy. It was a pity he hadn't studied her handwriting more carefully, but he would see it today if he contrived to sit behind her. He would have to enter the theatre just after her, and hope that the seat behind hers was not already occupied. If it was... Of course it would be, she was always late. In that case, he would have to sit right behind her, right beside her. No, that would be too obvious, and anyway, her friends would be sitting beside her. His roll had an unpleasantly floury crust. It powdered the inside of his mouth. He took a swallow of coffee. The girl diagonally opposite was wearing a wine-red cardigan. It looked Italian. She wasn't talking anymore, so he had to pretend he was looking past her into the kitchens over the rim of his cup. Then he picked up the letter. More likely it was from the library. You were only allowed 10 books and he had lost count. It had only just come to their attention that he had 11 books on loan, and would he please return one as soon as possible? Which one would it be? Not Kafka's letters. Better to give them the book on idealism. He would never finish it. He had finished his breakfast. The girls were talking about a mutual friend. They agreed with each other's analysis of her character. He would have liked to stay a while and hear more, but his tray was empty. He could get another cup of coffee, but he didn't like it very much. It was lukewarm and murky. He left the table, putting the letter in his pocket. It wasn't from the library. They stamped the envelope with an internal mail postmark, or sent a postcard. It was cheaper that way. No, it was a personal letter. There was no doubt about it. Despite long grey curtains, some sunlight penetrated the lecture theatre. It fell on the board, making green patches like luminous moss. He was two rows behind the girl. He looked from her to the lecturer, to the lecturer's shadow on the board, back to the lecturer, to the girl, back to the letter. He couldn't see the girl's handwriting, only her back and her hair. He had been too slow in following her inside. He'd had to sit two rows behind, above, next to someone he didn't know. Now this person next to him was turning to him, looking at him. It was quite embarrassing, because he didn't know whether to ignore her or look back. He couldn't ignore her, because she had noticed the movement, and she had surely registered his notice, and knew that if he didn't look back, he was ignoring her deliberately. She was certainly looking at him deliberately. It was quite embarrassing. He pretended to be taking notes. He wrote, "The Subjectivist Fallacy, Hegel versus Kant." The lecturer had said something like this. The girl beside him had turned back to her notes. The girl two rows in front was still rigid, a back and hair. The letter lay before him, between him and his neighbour. Papers were rustling. People began to talk. The lecturer closed his briefcase and held the door for a student before leaving the theatre. The letter lay before him. He gathered up his notes and put them inside his pad, dropping the letter between two blank pages. He looked at the girl next to him. She was looking at him. He was startled, turned on his heel and stepped out of the aisle. The girl followed close behind. The other girl still sat with her friends two rows in front. Perhaps the letter wasn't from her. Why should it be? She never looked at him. What about this girl behind, who did, for sure? It was obvious, perhaps, that she had written the letter. She was close behind. First he crossed the threshold, then she. First he turned the corner, then she. He stopped at the notice board. She did too. It was probably just a letter from the Arts Club announcing the next meeting. A slideshow of local crafts, a demonstration of perspective by a naive painter. People don't write each other letters, he thought. Not when they live close by. He felt nervous. He didn't want to move away. Why did she not move away? He could hear her breathing. He was reading the same line of an orange poster over and over. The words were sharp and stern. He didn't know what they meant. He fumbled with his pad. He fished out the letter. The girl stood beside him. The shape of her face was visible in profile. He pushed his pad under his arm. With both hands, he tore open the letter. Midday. How hot it is today in the square. The cathedral casts no shadow over the flagstones, so we, the painters, must stand like statues with shadows for pedestals. If only someone would come, but no, the steps descend to the street quite empty. The tourists are lying in their hotel bedrooms, murmuring to each other like pigeons. It really is too hot for work today. My canvases are baking. In a moment they will crack. The others stand in their customary arc. We form a battery before the cathedral. We face the steps. All visitors must scan our wares before stepping into the deep shadows beyond the heavy wooden door. How cool it must be in there. I've been inside, I assure you, though it was certainly long ago. Perhaps when I was a child. I remember the tallness of the place, and light which streamed through the high-up windows and was lost somewhere in the atmosphere. I lit a candle and put it with the others. None of us go in there now. It is our fate to stand here in our curved line. There must be 12 of us. We seldom speak. Sometimes we sketch or smoke. Our paintings are getting old, but there is no need to make new ones until the old are sold. None of us has painted for some time. What need when no one comes? Sometimes I walk along the line, kicking a stone and glancing at the others' work. I know it by heart. It never changes. If, but it is very rare, a picture is sold, a new one is painted. It is identical. So, when I stroll along the line, I do so apologetically. Although they do not speak, my colleagues have their ways, they have their likes and dislikes, and I must not inspect too often. It is an indulgence I must forego. Mostly we are content in peace. We have our thoughts. The cathedral is a help in this. It stands serene behind us, sobers us. Ahead, the steps fall to the street where sometimes traffic passes between the trees. We watch the birds move lazily in the upper branches. We count the chiming of the hour. We smoke or sketch. Perhaps someone would come if it were not so hot. But the sun is beating down on the flagstones, and the afternoon has only just begun. The stadium lights. The lights have just come on the stadium. From here atop the mast, careful, the bulbs are hot. You can see the whole area down there. On the outer track, an athlete is running, and as he disappears from view beneath our country, you can just about hear his breath. Although it sounds painful, it is meticulously regular. But he never flags, this man. His training seems to have brought him the gift of perpetual motion. He may stop quite suddenly, but it's just as likely that he'll keep on running. He feels safer like that. You've noticed the groundsmen, I see. Not everybody does. The way they huddle over their work, they might easily be taken for a couple of vaulting horses. Occasionally one of them, crazed with boredom, takes a hop over the other and back. That's usually enough. Then they get on with it. Laying turf, you see. We're very proud of our turf. It's constantly being renewed. I dare say we could bring in a team of men to do the whole place once a year or so, but it's better this way, to my mind. These chaps work their way in a spiral towards the centre, then out again in an interlocking spiral, lifting and relaying, lifting and relaying. Pointless? No, it impresses our visitors no end. I always ask them their opinion of the turf, and never have I had an adverse comment. I make a point of passing the really encouraging remarks on to the men, and they're grateful for it in their uncommunicative way. Of course, now our activities have been restricted to the outer track, we can really concentrate on perfecting the turf. Soon it'll be a rival for the most manicured Japanese garden. There were difficult times, though, when the crowds used to fill the stands from end to end. When one particularly popular athlete knocked an eighth of a second off the record for the 100-meter sprint, we had them all over, kicking up whole squares of turf, leaving great gashes everywhere. It was quite horrific. It was all I could do to persuade our groundsmen not to leave us, and they've never fully recovered from the shock. Look, here comes the runner again. Under, hidden, then away, same pace as ever. Phenomenal. He's not an athlete, you know. A lawyer, I believe. Solicitor, something like that. Very little is known about him, to tell the truth. He's hardly arrived at the stadium before he's out there, circling the track. The groundsmen complain that he makes them dizzy, but they depend upon him to time their work. They can uproot and lay 5 turf squares in the time it takes him to complete 1 lap, on a good day at least. When it's wet, they're hampered by mud, but the solicitor keeps to his regular pace. Well, since you ask, there are a few rumours, not that I give them much credence myself. They say, for instance, that he has an unbearable grief, which can only be controlled by these daily feats of exertion. By one report, he lost his whole family in the cycling accident in the Alps, though I detect some fanciful embellishment in the details. Alternatively, our janitor claims to have had a long conversation with the man, in which he confided that his greatest fear was of being trapped in the city after the announcement of nuclear attack, and he had resolved to use the 30 minutes warning period to make his escape on foot, effortlessly passing the queues of congested traffic. I should add that our janitor is a most untrustworthy character, and we only keep him on because the poor fellow was deaf. So these tales only increase the runner's enigma, and what's more, distract the staff from their work. But they flourish despite my discouragements. As for myself, I have to admit an admiration for the man. What enterprise, what resolution, what determination. He's an example to us all. I can watch him enraptured for hours. As long as he is here, we can justify keeping the stadium open. There have been suggestions that we should sell tickets and let the public marvel at him from the stands, but I wouldn't hear of it, not for a moment. It would be a flagrant invasion of the privacy of such a sensitive man. If you doubt that he's sensitive, just look there. The fine ankles, the poise of the spine, and the exquisite flow of his movements. The man's an artist. But come, it's getting late. I must turn off the lights. There. Don't worry. I'll guide you down the ladder. Your eyes will soon adjust. There's plenty of light from Ursa Major. How fine it is tonight. It's my favourite constellation. No, don't look up. You'll get vertigo. You'll soon feel the ground beneath your feet, but for the time being, just follow my voice. What's that? The groundsman? The runner? My dear fellow, don't trouble yourself. The lights were for your benefit alone. I expect they'll be glad that our intrusion is over, and meanwhile we have real business to attend to. Just put them quite out of your mind. There's no point even in straining your ears. You won't hear anything, and we still have a long way to descend. But just follow my voice. Just... voice. Police photograph. The officer in charge of operations stood on the bridge of the launch. He missed the gannet, diving recklessly. It was out of his range of vision. The concrete piers and jetties reflected the scream of his loud hailer. His divers were apprehensive. They spoke of pipes tangled on the harbour floor, lingering with intent. Disrespectful gulls mocked the officer as he waited. A cameraman had taken light readings and was ready when the rubber broke up through the surface of the water. Some months later, the Gannet sat on its pierside dome of rock. Beside it, fish-like, lay an old soaked newspaper. Flanked by divers, dots and tones represented the figure of a man, in jeans and cowboy boots, breaking the surface of what must have been harbour water. The fish the Gannet had just glimpsed was passing through the caption. Mountaineering on territories of unfused glass which depthless press of shoreless spaces sheared the gloss on every face. How light would glance or sink refract if bluff could be distinguished from the black, and high would ascend each inestimable height if each flat slope were not upright. Meanwhile, this unblown globe bowls on in random orbit home.